Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What are the long-term ramifications of the economic doldrums we've struggled through for the past several years? As millions of Americans try to make ends meet after losing a job, those fortunate enough still to be employed agonize about property values and prospects for retirement. And despite the continued financial gloom, we all look forward to the day when things turn around. But my guest today argues that even a significant uptick in the economy won't be enough to erase the damage that's already been done. And he worries that today's problems have set in motion a hollowing out of the American middle class that is likely to last long after stock markets and employment rates rebound. Author Don Peck covers the economy and society for The Atlantic magazine, where he also serves as features editor. His new book is called Pinched: How the Great Recession Has Narrowed Our Futures and What We Can Do About It. Don, welcome to Think.
It's a pleasure to be here, Chris.
So one of the things you did here was to look at major downturns in the past and discovered that they always leave behind long-term changes. Talk about that.
Absolutely. You know, I think that before this downturn, a lot of your listeners were probably used to recessions in recent decades that were shallow, brief, and really every way temporary. But when you look at longer downturns in America's history, the 1970s, the 1930s, the 1890s, you know, periods where unemployment was high and most people weren't getting ahead for a number of years, you really do see permanent changes to society. When people are unemployed for long periods of time, a year, 2 years, or more, you know, their personal habits change, their skills erode, their family life changes, the communities in which they live often go downhill, and those sorts of changes simply aren't easily reversed, even once times grow more prosperous again. The character and prospects of whole generations have changed significantly during prolonged downturns in the past, particularly up-and-coming generations of young adults, you know, who are still finding their feet in the job market and who are still developing their outlook on life. In the Depression, certainly, we saw young people develop lifelong habits of thrift, a liberal political ideology. These things stayed with them for the rest of their lives, and I think there's substantial evidence, actually, that similar changes are occurring in the U.S. today.
So the ones who were, say, teenagers or between 10 and 20 during the worst years of the Depression ultimately did okay, and they grew up to be the greatest generation. However, the ones who were in their early 20s at the great crash of 29 did markedly less well.
That's right. You know, both history and substantial academic research shows us that people who are in their first few years in the job market during long, deep recessionary periods, they really struggle, you know, not just during those downturns, but for much of the rest of their careers. The first few years are extremely important to setting one's career track and kind of life trajectory. And people who struggle early, they not only start out behind, they never catch up. They get stuck in bad jobs. They get labeled by employers as low potential or underachieving, and it becomes very difficult for them to change that perception once it's set. What's more, their own attitudes often do begin to change. So in the Depression, people who experienced hardship in their 20s, you know, even decades later in their 60s, after countless booms and busts, still felt a sense of fatalism, a lack of agency, a sense that they couldn't do anything to improve their lot. And again, I mean, we're seeing that already, I think, to some extent with some millennials today. You know, millennials entered this recession as the most confident in American history, extremely optimistic and incredibly high material expectations. And in my reporting with millennials around the country today, you know, what I see are really substantial changes, and survey data back this up. I think millennials are becoming much more conservative about their careers. They're coming to favor a single employer throughout their career rather than multiple jobs. And their relationship to money itself is changing as well.
That's so interesting because it basically sounds like we as a generation of adults didn't prepare this next generation for the kind of hardship that they faced right after they got out of school.
Well, I think in many ways that's correct. I mean, when you think about parenting styles and school curricula over the past 20 years or so, we've been telling children more and more that they're special, that they're destined for great things. We've been valuing self-esteem to a very high degree and sometimes divorcing it from performance. So as a result of those things, the millennial generation, as it reached adulthood, was very confident and very individualistic, but perhaps unprepared for the realities of this marketplace, which really require extraordinary humility, a lot of hustle, a lot of entrepreneurialism. You know, early in the recession, the term funemployment became popular among young adults. Many simply moved back in with their parents. Now, some had no choice but to do that, mm-hmm. but no small number felt that they could simply wait the recession out, and that when things got better, they would simply step onto the track that they had always imagined for themselves. Unfortunately, everything we know about these sorts of periods indicates that that's not the case, and I do think that many millennials rue today their reactions to the first couple of years of the crisis.
So it would seem the perfect time for people in a position to do so, to sort of wait it out by getting some more education. Of course, this is incredibly expensive today, and you really need, whereas a bachelor's degree 25 years ago was pretty much a guarantee of a solid job and a good employment future, now you need a master's degree for that.
Well, I mean, it's true that professional degrees are, to a large extent, what college degrees used to be. And if you look at unemployment rates, for example, for people with professional degrees, it's about 2% today. So if you have a professional degree, even in this deep, horrible recession, you know, for the most part, you're very likely to be still doing just fine. However, among college graduates, the unemployment rate is only 4.5% versus 9% for the country as a whole. So, you know, you're absolutely right that a college degree isn't the kind of security that it used to be. And college graduates haven't done that well across the last decade. You know, at the same time, there's a lot of talk today in the media that maybe a college degree isn't worth it anymore. It's very interesting. You know, as I was researching Pinched, I noted that sentiment also grew during the 1930s. Hmm. And it wasn't true then, and it really doesn't seem to be true now. The return on a college degree is still near its historic high today. And I think a lot of the troubles that college graduates in particular are experiencing today, you know, they will be mitigated as we recover. You know, jobs will reappear for college graduates. It's really the people who haven't finished college, people with a high school diploma but not a college degree, that I think are as a group and regardless of age, facing a somewhat more dire set of circumstances in this economy. Because as you said at the top of the program, you know, part of what's happened in this recession, you know, is not just cyclical. Part of what's happened is the middle class, the non-professional middle class, has been hollowing very quickly. And people in particular with a high school but not a college degree have been losing their jobs in record numbers.
Define what you mean by hollowing. Is there just a sense that it's not easy to recognize middle class anymore?
Well, I mean, I think our classes in the U.S. are sort of separating and changing. And, you know, when you just look at the breakdown of the population, only 30% of Americans have a bachelor's degree or better. Even among young adults, that's true. So the real center of American society, you know, the true middle class of the U.S. are people who have finished high school, maybe gotten a little bit of extra training or an associate's degree, but not gotten a bachelor's degree. You know, that's about 60% of the population. And David Autor, an economist at MIT, has looked at the structure of job losses in this recession. And what he's found is that overwhelmingly on net, the jobs lost have been what he calls middle skill jobs. These are jobs in manufacturing, jobs in the office, in non-managerial roles like clerks or administrative assistants. The jobs overwhelmingly that have provided a middle class life to high school graduates. So it's this group of people really who have been falling out of the middle class in large numbers. You know, and as we've seen some employment growth in recent months, what we've seen is the jobs that are coming back are not middle skill jobs. They are low skill jobs that have typically been the sort taken by high school dropouts, you know, jobs at $10, $15 an hour. Increasingly, the people who've lost their jobs in this recession are now competing for those jobs. So that's what I mean by a hollowing in the middle class. And it's really high school graduates without a college degree that seem most severely affected today.
Are these people shifting their politics to more progressive views?
Well, I mean, I think you need to differentiate between people who've actually lost their jobs and people who haven't. And yes, I mean, I think that people who've been unemployed for a year or 2 years now, and the average duration of unemployment in the U.S. is 9 months, by the way, the highest it's ever been since that stat was recorded in 1948. Yes, those people, I mean, I think are becoming more liberal and for very understandable reasons. But, you know, that's not what's happened in the broader society. And that's also the norm in long periods of malaise or disappointment. What we've seen in the past is as people lose the sense that they're getting ahead, if they don't directly require immediate government support, you know, what tends to happen is they begin to view life in zero-sum terms. Support for the poor tends to diminish in periods like this. Anti-immigrant sentiment usually swells. People become more jealous of their status of relative to others, and kind of politics in general becomes more mean-spirited. So I think that's really what we've, you know, overwhelmingly what we've seen today, and that too has predicates in the past.
You said that the average duration of unemployment is 9 months right now. At or around 7 months, we start to see really deleterious effects in terms not simply of people's finances, but of how they're living their lives. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, a recent Rutgers survey of people who'd been unemployed for 7 months or more showed pretty significant changes in their personal lives. Over half of them were withdrawing from their friends and avoiding social encounters because of embarrassment and a lack of money. Over half of them described strife within their families as a result of their unemployment. A large majority weren't sleeping well through the night. About 15% had developed a substance problem. So when you look at unemployment that extends past a few months, it's not just a problem of paychecks and bank accounts as people sometimes think of it. You know, it's a much more severe psychological problem. You know, particularly among men, identity still derives so much from work that when work is lost, you know, people lose a sense of self. Happiness researchers have looked at the effects of prolonged unemployment on personal well-being, and they found that it's just about the worst thing that can happen to anyone. It's psychologically the equivalent of the death of a spouse, and it's a kind of bereavement in its own right. So part of the problem that we have in the U.S. today, and I think part of the reason why getting out of this period faster is even more urgent than many people might believe, is that these sorts of scars, once they occur, they endure. And so the longer we're in a period like this one, the worse they're going to be.
Don Peck is features editor at The Atlantic Magazine. His new book is called Pinched: How the Great Recession Has Narrowed Our Futures and What We Can Do About It. You can join the conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Don Peck. He serves as features editor at The Atlantic magazine and is the author of the new book Pinched, How the Great Recession Has Narrowed Our Futures and What We Can Do About It. Join the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Don, I've been fascinated to follow, not with any particular pleasure, of course, how differently this recession has affected the prospects of men versus women in the workforce. And the explanations that you give here are really interesting because they're things that people might not have considered that explain why women seem to be doing better than men right now.
Yeah, there's been a clear distinction between men and women in this recession. This recession has been called the men-cession, and 3 out of 4 pink slips delivered during the recession were delivered to men, not women. And, you know, in part, that's because men tend to work more in construction and manufacturing, which are very cyclical industries. But this is really, again, an acceleration of a longstanding trend. You know, since the U.S. began to move from an industrial economy to a post-industrial economy in the 1970s, men have really struggled more and more. You know, as blue-collar opportunities, as outdoor opportunities have declined, a meaningful number of men simply have not adapted very well. College has become more important to success in the U.S. since the 1970s. Women have adapted to that. Yet college graduation rates among men really haven't changed much since about 1980. And at the same time, men have not moved into growing fields like healthcare, education, service fields where women continue to dominate. You know, what men have done instead, and again, this is not just in this recession, it's really over 30 years, but we see it accelerating greatly in this recession, is they've simply dropped out of the workforce. In 1967, among men with a high school degree of prime working age, 97% were working. Today, that number is just 76%. And in a post-industrial economy where personal presentation, social skills, you know, reliability, you know, where these things matter more and more, where brute strength matters less and less, you know, not all men certainly, but a meaningful number of men have really struggled over many, many years to adapt.
Of course, you know, permanently dropping out of the workforce is only an option if you have significant savings or if you have a family or, in particular, a spouse to support you. And this is another thing that this recession has affected.
It has. You know, when you know, men, the men I talk to who used to be in construction, say, who are not working today and who can't find jobs today, I mean, you know, they rely on family, they rely on a girlfriend, they kind of move from place to place as they can kind of catch, you know, a room somewhere. But their lives are very unstable, and that's what we see when men aren't working. You know, women tend not to marry men who aren't working or who are economically insecure, but they do have children with them. And I think that is really one of the most important consequences of this recession and more generally of the kind of increasing struggles of blue-collar men over time, is that, you know, it's not just that women are becoming the economic center of households, you know, which can be great news. It's that families themselves are changing, and we're seeing a lot more single parenthood and kind of unsettled lives for children as a result of these economic changes. You know, children don't do well typically when their lives are unsettled, when they live in single parent households, and in communities where there's high unemployment, high male unemployment in particular. You know, the entire character of those communities, you know, are changing. You know, much the way inner cities changed in the 1970s when manufacturing suddenly left inner cities and black men within them lost their jobs and couldn't find new jobs. So we're kind of on the brink of social changes in blue-collar communities across the country that if we don't correct them, and we can correct them, but if we don't correct them, I fear could lead to the loss of opportunity and upward mobility for a generation of children within these communities.
Let's check in with our listeners now on the phone at 1-800-933-5372. First on the line is Tony in Dallas. Hello, Tony.
Hi. I am delighted that you are having this particular topic on your program today. Because the other day there was a program on NPR, and the speaker was talking about the current recession in employment and effects of employment. I'm hoping that your speaker today can expound on a point the other one made, and that's that when someone loses their job, they lose a certain certainty about it, self-assurance, because they become acutely aware that they can lose their job. And they are always aware, and that awareness never goes away. So even when they find work again, there's always this stress level or nervousness that it's going to happen again, that they're going to lose their job again. So could your speaker expound on that point, please?
Thanks for your call. What do you
think,
John?
Thank you very much.
Well, Tony is exactly right, and in my book Pinched, I look at the many ways in which an episode of unemployment affects the rest of your life. You know, people who lose their jobs, they have an elevated risk of death in every year after they've lost their jobs, even once they find employment again. And you know, scholars think that is because in part of higher stress levels, greater uncertainty, and perhaps reduced access to health care for a time as well. But, you know, it creates permanent changes, basically, in the health of people. As we've talked about already, it certainly creates changes in their psychological health. You know, young people, for instance, who experience a six-month bout of unemployment or more in their early 20s, by middle age, are much more likely to have depressive symptoms. They're more likely to be heavy drinkers. And again, this includes people that have subsequently found work. So again, you know, I think that one of the most important conclusions we can draw about the current recession is that it's not truly temporary, that the longer it stretches on, the more we're going to see, you know, lasting damage to many people in this country, to many Americans, and less ability to recover, you know, among those people. So it really adds urgency to trying to reduce the unemployment rate, create new jobs, and get out of this period as fast as we possibly can.
So do we create new jobs by making the conditions ideal for corporations and small businesses, or do we create new jobs, at least in the short term, by literally creating more government jobs?
We need to do both, actually. You know, when you look at the severity of this recession and also the structural elements of it and the problems that the non-professional middle class in particular are having, you know, there's no silver bullet for our problems today. We need to engage in a wide array of actions, and I describe those in Pinched. But in the short run, really the most important thing that we need to do is more government support for job creation and for kind of stimulation of the economy. You know, consumers are greatly indebted today following the housing bubble, and it's going to take another couple of years for them to pay down their personal debts. In the interim, it is necessary and appropriate for the government to step in, provide the spending that consumers can, and yes, to create jobs directly. We should be spending much more on infrastructure today, for instance, which has been deteriorating for years. We've been underinvesting in infrastructure anyway. By really ramping up our spending today, we could create jobs for the unemployed construction workers, manufacturing workers who've been hardest hit in this recession. You know, but we do need to do more than just short-term stimulus. You know, we do need to reinvigorate innovation and kind of breakthrough technological progress, which was surprisingly slow in the aughts in the U.S. and is one of the problems we face today. We can do that both through more investment in science and R&D and through really a different method of regulating companies and trying to give small firms and young growing industries the running room that they need to grow and to create jobs.
Back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We're speaking with Don Peck about his new book, Pinched. Let's go this time to Mark in Arlington. Hello, Mark.
Hi. Your guest spoke of a college graduate getting a return on their investment in a college degree. And my question is, does he think that our definition of what constitutes a, quote, return has to change now that we have an entire generation of young people graduating with tens of thousands of dollars, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars in student loan debt?
Yeah, well, I mean, student debt is growing larger and larger, and I think we should try to take measures, to keep the costs of college down. I mean, you know, college costs have been growing, you know, faster than just about any costs in the economy, you know, other than healthcare, and that is a real problem, and we need to address it. But you know, even given those costs, college, you know, scholarly research shows, you know, that a college degree really does still make sense. And, you know, you can look at that any number of ways. I talked about simply the unemployment rate earlier. You know, if you're a college graduate, the unemployment rate is 4.5% today. If you didn't finish college, if you only finished high school, I believe that rate is up around 15%. If you dropped out of high school, it's much, much higher. And there are still really big wage and income differences between people who finished college and people who didn't. So I agree with Mark that the cost of college and the debt that students have to take frequently now to go to college is a real problem, but that doesn't change the fact that college still does remain a good investment for the most part.
We have an email here from Bob who says, it seems that seniors are more often adversely affected than other groups, yet the plight of this cohort is seldom a focus of discussions on the topic. What are your observations on the impact of the recession on seniors?
Well, seniors have actually lost jobs. People in their 50s, 60s have actually lost jobs less frequently than other segments of the population, which is interesting and I think surprising, you know, in this recession. However, when people in those demographics do lose their jobs, it's a life-changing event. There is abundant age discrimination, you know, in the U.S. today among employers. And, you know, frequently people who are, you know, later in life, they find it more difficult to retrain as well. So, I talked to one guy, you know, outside of Philadelphia, you know, a year ago, who, you know, he was a financial analyst at a local hospital. He thought he was quite employable, but he was 59. He lost his job, and he was just continually unable to find anything else. He's working part time at Walmart now because it's the only work he could find. His hours are on weekends. You know, his wife's are on weekdays, so they don't see each other very much anymore. And you know, this is a dilemma that's facing, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in their 50s and 60s. When those people lose their jobs, it's highly unlikely that they're going to find work that pays comparably, and many really struggle to find work at all. So it's true. I mean, this is yet another problem that we're seeing in this recession. You know, people who thought they were about to retire, that they were going to be able to retire in a few years, can't. And again, their self-image, not just their bank accounts, you know, have often taken huge blows.
And yet the wealthy in this country seem to be doing just fine.
Well, that's right, and that's a distinctive feature of this period, I think. You know, when you think about the Depression, there was a sense that everyone was struggling together. You know, one of the iconic images of the Depression was bankers on street corners selling apples. You know, clearly, there is no comparable image today, and different classes have felt this recession very, very differently. Over the last 20 years or so, America's best educated, highest income people have increasingly flocked to a handful of power cities and creative enclaves across the country, you know, Manhattan, Silicon Valley, Raleigh-Durham, Austin, Washington, D.C. And in these places and among these classes, the recession was shallower, housing fell less, and now these places are beginning to boom again. Wage growth has been very rapid in Manhattan, Silicon Valley over the past year or so. Washington, D.C. is the most optimistic city in America as to the state and future of the economy. And people, you know, the rich lost less of their assets than the middle class did during the recession. They've rebounded much faster. So there's been a clear distinction among classes and among places in the way different people have experienced this recession. And, you know, I think that actually accounts for some of the reaction to the jobless crisis in Washington. You know, influential people, you know, and including the political class, simply haven't felt the recession the way that most Americans have. And in their social interactions, the people around them, for the most part, also have felt the recession only lightly. I think that's one reason why we haven't been as attentive to the problem of joblessness as we should be, and why our government really lost its focus on job creation soon after the stock market bounced in 2009.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have James calling from Carrollton. Hi, James.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
What I was talking about, I want to say, is I second everything the gentleman has just said. My wife has been unemployed for 3 years. Hmm. She worked for a small financial, what you'd call a mid-sized financial company. They automated the department she was in. She was laid off, and she couldn't find anything else. And she's like, she was 59 or 58 when she got laid off. And it's just, everything that he has said is true, because I live with her, and I see it, you know. She's trying to get another job, and she has two other degrees, and she just, it's hard. And we live in the Dallas area, so, you know, and you think it has a booming city. I just wanted to see what he would say about that.
Well, James, thanks so much for your call. I'm sorry to hear about what a hard time your wife has had. We'll get a response from Don after this break. We're speaking this hour with Don Peck, who is features editor at The Atlantic Magazine and author of the new book, Pinched, How the Great Recession Has Narrowed Our Futures and What We Can Do About It. You can join us on the phone at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Journalist Don Peck is my guest this hour. His new book is called Pinched, How the Great Recession Has Narrowed Our Futures and What We Can Do About It. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. And that's where we heard Don from James before the break. And sadly, the story that he told about his wife struggling to find work in her late 50s is not unfamiliar to you.
No, it's all too common across the country today. And you know, people who lose their jobs, who can't find new work, they become sort of invisible to the rest of us. They can, at least, because, you know, one thing that happens with long-term unemployment is people's social networks shrink. They become more isolated. They shrink more and more into within the walls of their own house. And I think it's just really important for all of us, however we're doing, to kind of recognize that there are millions of people in the U.S. that are really struggling badly today, and we may not always see them in our daily lives, but they're out there, and I think we owe it to them and to ourselves as a society, to really focus on providing you know, job opportunities, you know, for these people, to growing the economy. One problem that we've never had in the U.S. that we may have soon is a problem of chronic unemployment. You know, when people are out of work for long enough, a temporary unemployment becomes permanent. Employers simply begin to ignore them. They presume, rightly or wrongly, they presume some sort of personal or professional dysfunction. And it can be very, very difficult for people who've been out of work for a year or two or more to get back into the workforce, to get a job, even once the broader economy recovers. Europe had this problem in the 80s and 90s, and its unemployment rate was much higher for those two decades. You know, as a result, you know, one thing that I recommend in Pinched is I think we should begin offering employers pretty heavy subsidies specifically to rehire or to hire people who've been out of work for more than a year. Make the subsidy targeted, make it temporary, you know, only for a year, and then withdraw it. But that will encourage companies to take a chance on people who haven't been able to find work. It will allow those people to put something on their resume, to rebuild their skills, and to kind of reacquire the rhythm of the workplace. Even if they're not retained after a year, they will have recent experience, and that will help them moving forward. So I think, you know, we need to start addressing something we've really never had to address in the U.S. before, which is, you know, what specifically do we need to do in targeted fashion to help people who've become really chronically jobless and difficult to reemploy to find work?
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Abe on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Abe.
Hi. I was just listening. Mr. Peck, I read your article in the Atlantic. I have not gotten a chance to read your book yet. But my question, I'm on active duty. I'm a public affairs officer in the military. So kind of a strange situation where a profession that requires strong interpersonal skills in a male-dominated organization. One thing that I didn't see in the magazine is any numbers on veteran unemployment, which is relatively high as well. And I'm curious, do you view the military as an advantageous organization that provides troops, young males, vehicles like the GI Bill and other things to provide social mobility, or do you view it as a disadvantageous organization because a lot of the professions don't translate well into the private sector?
You have an interesting statistic in the book about where young military recruits are coming from geographically, Don. Maybe you can talk to that as well.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the military has historically been a great engine for upward mobility in the U.S. and has provided great opportunities for recruits as they, you know, as they leave the military through education and because of the skills and self-discipline that they've developed. I don't know if that has changed. I unfortunately I'm not an expert on that. Historically, it's been true, but as Chris was noting, I mean, one thing we are seeing, which I don't think is healthy, is the military itself more and more is drawing from kind of historically poor places in the U.S., you know, places where most people do not go to college. If you look at death rates, for instance, you know, in the Afghanistan and Iraq wars, you know, Bismarck, North Dakota had something like four times the death rate of, you know, of say San Francisco. And so we're seeing kind of in this geographic cleavage in the U.S., you know, we're seeing less and less military recruitment from big, technologically advanced, vibrant cities and more from kind of the places that are being left behind, the Rust Belt. Recently, certain Sun Belt cities like Las Vegas, Phoenix, Tampa, you know, which seemed to be middle-class meccas, but with the housing bust have been revealed to some extent as mirages. So there's almost a form of economic conscription that's been at work, you know, over the last decade or so. I find that socially troubling. But Abe asks a great question, which is, you know, does the military, even if they are recruiting predominantly in areas of low opportunity, does it act as an elevator for the people who enter and come through it? Historically, it has. I don't know the extent to which it still is.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Melody in Dallas. Hi, Melody.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. And thank you, Mr. Peck, for writing this book. I graduated from college in 1982 in Iowa in the middle of the recession at that time. And I was unemployed for 2 years. And basically, it took me 15 years to get into a job that really matched my skill set. And I mean, it is. It's had all the impacts that you talk about. It makes it very difficult, you know, to try to keep up with people that are 20 years your junior.
Hmm. So, Don, what can we do to sort of build resiliency?
Right. Well, you know, I think there are really a host of measures we need to take. And we've already talked about the need for, I think, more short-term stimulus and government support. We need to pair that, of course, with long-term debt reduction. The debt is a problem today, but we can address it in the long run, not this year. Job growth is ultimately dependent on innovation. We need to rebuild an innovation economy. But, you know, when you look at the travails of the middle class, the non-professional middle class in particular, you know, I also think we need to adapt better to a rapidly changing global environment in which, you know, a lot of people with only a high school degree, just they're facing more competition overseas. They're facing, you know, more competition from machines as well. And I think that there's a lot that we can do over the long run. This isn't a six-month solution to try to build more paths into the middle class from high school. We need, you know, we of course want and need to widen access to college for everyone. You know, but college can't be the only answer to the woes facing the middle class today. And I think that, you know, if we look to, you know, it's always dangerous to start looking at other countries and what they've done. They're different societies. But if you look at Germany, for instance, you know, they've been very successful at building good paths into the middle class from high school through apprenticeship programs, through vocational training, you know, through trade skills in addition to classroom skills. And these are things that I think we need to be doing more of in the U.S. while also encouraging people to go to college, because it allows people who ultimately decide not to go to college to see real careers ahead of them, to understand, you know, how they can build skills, and to understand, you know, what they need to do to reach, you know, a real secure career. Finally, you know, the other thing that I think we really need to do is political. You know, in an economy where more people are falling out of the middle class, you know, where I think many people who are mid-career, you know, will need to take, you know, fairly low-pay work in the future, I also think we owe it to ourselves to subsidize low-pay work more and more. Because the middle class is hollowing, because our society is separating, we need to make low-pay jobs more like middle-class jobs. You know, one way to do that is to simply subsidize the wages of those jobs so that they're more stable and offer a better livelihood. And yes, tax the rich a little bit more to pay for that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Sarah in Wichita Falls. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Well, my question is, I am a college graduate. I do have a bachelor's degree, but the best job I've been able to find as a production assistant only pays minimum wage, and I have student loans that are in excess of $80,000. How am I ever going to pay that off with a job like that? I mean, I don't really think college is worth it now, because the only requirement for that job was a high school diploma. I mean, is there anything that we can do to make college actually more affordable and worthwhile?
Yeah, well, I mean, Sarah is echoing a point of a previous caller, and it's a very valid point. You know, I'm not an expert on education and its financing, but yes, I think, you know, we do need to you know, to try to do something to rein in the inflation in college costs and make it more affordable for people. You know, one thing that, young people can do, young college graduates in particular can do that I think they sometimes aren't doing today is you know, be willing to move to different places. You know, mobility has always been a real asset in the U.S., and but we've really lost it in recent years. The U.S. population is about as immobile as it has ever been today, actually, in part because so many people own homes now, in part because so many married couples are dual earner households, so when one person loses a job, it's hard for the couple to move. You know, but young college graduates in particular can be more mobile. And you know, when you look across the country right now, different places are recovering at different rates. The unemployment rate in Minneapolis is about 6.5%. It's about 14.5% in Las Vegas. You know, job openings are really quite prevalent right now in, say, Washington, D.C. or in Baltimore. You know, they are not in Miami and Detroit. So I think that, you know, for young college graduates, for young people generally, you know, one piece of advice I would offer would be to cast the net widely geographically and be willing to take a chance and jump to a different part of the country, a different city, if the place that you know you're living is struggling right now. You know, that's one thing that young people at least, you know, can do today.
Does a city that is struggling like Phoenix, like Las Vegas, have the power to do anything for itself that somehow makes it, I mean, climate aside, makes it more resemble places like Austin and Minneapolis and D.C.?
Over time, sure, you know, and you know, the creation of a dynamic, high skill, really resilient economy begins typically with the creation of and building of great universities, the attraction of technological industries that can feed job growth up and down the ladder. That's difficult to do quickly, though, and I think one thing that we, you know, that we saw in the aughts in particular is, you know, Phoenix, Las Vegas, these were places that were growing anyway, but they were growing really quickly, almost entirely because of housing. You know, people with moderate education, with limited savings, were flocking to these cities because they could afford to live in them, because housing was cheap, but it was appreciating rapidly. So these places really offered kind of the trappings of upward mobility to a large number of Americans, despite the fact that they didn't really have a lot of highly productive industries within them. So you know, in the long run, you know, this can be hard to change, but in the long run, it can be changed. But I think in the short run, we're seeing a lot of places now that are really kind of stuck with too many people, with a relatively narrow skill base. And I do think, you know, we're already seeing Las Vegas shrinking. It was interesting, you know, U-Hauls from Los Angeles to Las Vegas around 2005 were much more expensive going from Los Angeles to Las Vegas. It's reversed now. It's much more expensive to rent a U-Haul truck leaving Las Vegas. So we're already seeing some of these places shrink. I think we'll see more of that in the next 2-3 years.
Don Peck covers the economy and society for The Atlantic magazine, where he also serves as features editor. His new book is called Pinched: How the Great Recession Has Narrowed Our Futures and What We Can Do About It. Don, it's been a great discussion. Thank you so much for giving us this hour.
It's been a pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.